I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 1st of July. Our guest this hour has written that the Charleston murders have renewed the sporadic debates over whether gun control might have prevented this latest of tragedies. So far, he says, the U.S. has not done something about it. He has done work on researching guns for a long, long time. He's been one of the leading empirical researchers in the Legal Academy for the past 25 years. And he has written extensively and done research on right to carry laws and found that they are associated with significant increase in violent crimes. He'll be with us this hour to talk about why it is that after so many mass shootings, the U.S. has not done something about it. Our phone number as we talk about this issue this hour, we've talked about it before, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And we will let President Barack Obama frame the issue for us, as he did after the murders in Charleston.
Once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Now is the time for mourning and for healing. But let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it. I say that recognizing the politics in this town foreclose a lot of those avenues right now. But it'd be wrong for us not to acknowledge it. And at some point, it's going to be important for the American people to come to grips with it.
Professor John Donahue is our guest. He is a law professor at Stanford University, and he's been studying guns and mass shootings and violence in this country for some 25 years. Professor Donahue, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, good. Glad to be with you, Kathleen.
The president said at some point we as a country have to reckon with the fact this kind of mass violence doesn't happen in other advanced countries and we'll have to do something about it. You have written, so far the U.S. has not done something about it. The obvious question is why?
Well, there are a lot of factors at play. Obviously, the single most important factor in sort of thwarting sensible gun policy has been the power of the gun lobby. The domestic gun industry is very powerful, and they have also been successful in their efforts to constitutionalize aspects of gun holding in a way that also makes it more difficult to address gun policy in a sensible way.
The other shooting, the one in Charleston was horrendous. The other one that took everybody aback were the shootings in Newtown in 2012. You cite this figure, which really is amazing. 90% of Americans, including a majority of NRA members, wanting universal background checks to be adopted, but there was no federal action. It is hard to understand that.
Yeah, it is quite surprising. Actually, in the survey, 74% of NRA members wanted universal background check, and I think that is probably one of the most telling numbers that you can find in the entire gun debate, because essentially the NRA is not responsive to its members, it's responsive to the gun lobby. And if you had universal background checks, that would close off a profitable avenue of gun sales. And so the gun lobby is uninterested in that, even though 74% of NRA members would support universal background checks, which is a very sensible and wise move that most other advanced countries adopted long ago.
And who's in the gun lobby?
Well, it's essentially gun sellers and gun manufacturers, and they have managed to exercise enormous power. You know, part of it is wetting the interests of a you know, essentially a commercial interest with the, you know, very legitimate and longstanding interest for gun ownership among the public at large. That has been a very formidable obstacle for you know, a sensible gun policy and other countries that have been successful in engaging in efforts at more effective gun control were not encumbered by this. Specifically, Australia was able to make some bold steps because they did not have this combination of a very powerful domestic gun industry coupled with the constraints of constitutional law.
Do you imagine that we will see any kind of new legislation in Congress as a result of the Charleston murders?
I would be very surprised. It's going to take much more action on the part of the 90% before Congress is willing to act. And you know, as we see, this is true in certain areas of the financial sector where a commercial interest will have outsized power over Congress, and the gun area is a second area where a commercial interest has outsized power over Congress. So in certain states, you're able to see it where the power of the gun lobby is less potent. But at Congress, at this point, they're still very beholden to gun interests.
We even heard people say after the Charleston shootings that if people in the church had been armed, this wouldn't have happened. Tell me about this belief on the part of some gun owners that guns do have a great power to protect you against a terrorist or against a perceived enemy.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a perfect world, if you were under attack, suddenly a gun would slip into your hand and you'd be able to use it and it would disappear for the, you know, vast majority of time where you don't want to have a gun around. But that's not the world we live in. So one of the questions is, does it make sense for more people to go around carrying guns? And, you know, in a very, very small percentage of cases, guns are able to be used effectively to threaten or ward off a criminal attack. But it is a very unusual and unlikely event. And the benefits that one gets from that are small relative to the costs that the sort of uncontrolled gun ownership imposes in the United States.
For people who have guns, loaded guns in their homes and have them there as a source of protection, and I'm sure there are millions of Americans who do,
yep.
You cite this study of single-family dwellings in Atlanta. Tell me what that study found.
You know, it was an interesting study where they actually looked over a period of time at 198 instances where there was an invasion into the home, a burglary into the home when there was an occupied residence. And this was in Atlanta, Georgia, so, you know, part of the South, a very substantial gun-owning population. And in only three of the 198 cases was a gun used in sort of self-defense or to threaten the intruder. And in six cases, so in other words, twice as often, the gun was actually procured by the intruder. And so it gives you a sense that, A, it's an unusual event when guns are effectively employed in defense. And in that particular study, the number of cases where the gun was procured by the attacker was twice as great.
The other new research that you've done is on right to carry.
Yes, well, sort of the best case scenario that the NRA has tried to advocate for is right to carry laws that allow citizens who pass certain types of requirements and pay a fee to get a permit to carry a gun on their person as they go about their business during the day. And 38 states now have adopted these laws. And this has been a very active area of research for many years. And I have just completed probably the most comprehensive assessment of these laws over the longest period of time with the most complete data. And the results are very strongly indicative that passing these laws is associated with increases in violent crime rather than decreases, as the NRA might have you believe.
So who looks at the results of those, the study that you just did? Is it in the hands of lawmakers? Is it being carefully deliberated? Because it should be, shouldn't it?
Well, I am hopeful. This study is very new, so it hasn't been fully vetted by the public in the way that I hope it will and assume it will be. But Congress has not been particularly concerned with the merits of the case. They're much more concerned with the politics of the case, and right now the politics are not there. But these sorts of studies do have an impact on the federal judiciary, where at least you have an opportunity to bring the evidence in and allow testimony to the effect of what is the effect of various types of gun control or gun uncontrol measures. And so since the federal judiciary is analyzing a lot of these issues as they consider attacks brought by the NRA against various types of gun control, these studies will have an impact at that level.
Mm-hmm. The U.S., by far the world leader in the number of guns. I have read somewhere it's 300 million guns in civilian hands.
It's hard to know the precise number, but the estimates are north of 300 million, and no one else comes close. So we have something like 40% of the world's guns are held in civilian hands in the United States.
Why?
Again, it's a combination of a number of factors. Guns have always been a part of American culture from the early days. Frontier days, and hunters obviously need guns to engage in a sport that they are fond of, and target shooters need guns. But the thing that's most troubling to me is the misconceptions that the NRA perpetrates in the way of making people think that they can only be safe if they have a gun. And so a lot of guns are purchased under illusions of what the benefits and the costs of those guns will be.
Let's take, before we go to phone calls, a look at some other countries in the world, as you have done. Germany. Is it easy to buy a gun in Germany?
You know, Germany is very much like most other European countries, and they're much more careful in determining who will have access to guns. So in Germany, France, England, all of these countries, you either are going to be prohibited from having certain types of guns, as in England and Japan, where you're not allowed to have handguns at all, or in other countries, there will be a much more careful screening. It's almost always a requirement that you have some particularized need to have a gun and show that you're a responsible person. If you're under age 25 in many of these nations, there's a special requirement. And as we see, many of the mass shootings are indeed, young or even adolescent males who are having various types of mental disturbances. And I think it makes eminent good sense to screen out guns from such individuals.
Mm-hmm. You have written about Australia, the Port Arthur massacre, in which the conservative federal government did put forward and pass tough new gun control laws throughout the country of Australia, banning a large number of weapons, including the kind of weapon used in the Charleston shootings.
Yeah, the Australia case is quite remarkable. They had an absolutely horrendous mass shooting in 1996. far more people were killed there than even in the Newtown killing. And the response was very dramatic. The conservative prime minister said, we have to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And even though he was fearful of the response because angry gun owners were very unhappy with the proposed gun buyback and ban, and in fact he wore a bulletproof vest when he made the announcement, the results have been really remarkable. And there's virtually no chance today that Australia would go back on the decision that they made in 1996 because it has been deemed such a success.
So what's different? What's different about Australia? We have a lot in common with them, don't we?
Yeah, we certainly have a lot in common. The two things that we don't have in common is Australia does not have a domestic gun industry, which is the single greatest impediment to good gun policy. And then the second is that they did not have any constitutional constraint on the decisions that they made to promote safety for the entire population.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We're talking about the Charleston murders, renewing the debates that we have after each one of these mass shootings, and the question is whether gun control might have prevented this latest of tragedies. The president says it is in our power to do something about it, and we will have to reckon with the fact this kind of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. Why is it the U.S. has not done something about it? What do you think needs to be done? We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor John Donahue is a professor of law at Stanford University. He's an economist as well as a lawyer and has been doing empirical analyses of the impact of law and public policy in many areas: civil rights, anti-discrimination law, employment discrimination, crime and criminal justice, and school funding. To you, momentarily, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Professor John Donahue is our guest, and we start our calls with Matt in Sparta. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. So my comment today is, first of all, what happened with the church shooting was appalling, and he should be punished to the full extent of the law, and it's a very, very tragic thing. However, what's underreported in the media is that gun ownership is as high as it's been in the last 40 years in the United States, and gun violence is actually as low as it has been in that same period, and that's taken from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, which is one of the most quoted or cited sources of gun statistics, and I feel like that's being underreported. Also, in the countries with very, very strict gun control, like Australia or Great Britain, you are more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. You are just less likely to die, which, granted, that's a big deal. You're more likely to die as a victim of violent crime in the United States because of the number of guns. However, you are more likely to be victimized in those other countries.
Professor Donahue.
I'm glad for the call, because there are actually a number of misconceptions that were uttered. First of all, on the issue of the prevalence of guns in the United States and the current crime rate, it is true that there are more guns now, but it's not clear that there are more individuals owning guns. In fact, there's much evidence that the actual percentage of Americans with guns is declining. But the more important question is, where is crime declining more? And, for example, crime has declined much more in New York State than in Texas, in part because New York has had a much more aggressive anti-gun policy than Texas has. Now, on the second point, the international comparisons are sometimes difficult to make. But it is absolutely not true that violent crime is worse in, for example, Australia than it is in the United States. The robbery rate in Australia is only about one-half the rate of the robbery rate in the United States. In 2012, it was 58 robberies per 100,000 people in Australia and 113 per 100,000 in the United States. Sometimes the international comparisons are difficult to make because some jurisdictions will include attempted rape or something in a measure of the category of sexual assault, and that will be compared with the uniform crime measure of rape in the United States, which doesn't include the attempted rape. And so you do have to be careful about the international comparison. Unfortunately, the NRA is very aggressive in misquoting and miscitingdata, and then that gets put out into the public, and then, you know, the public is confused about the actual facts.
You've written in one of your recent articles, I find this an interesting statement, the fact is that if NRA claims about the efficacy of guns in reducing crime were true, the U.S. would have the lowest homicide rate among industrialized nations instead of the highest homicide rate by a wide margin.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely true. If you listen and read NRA views on the magical power of guns to thwart crime, you know, you would think all you need is a gun and everything is going to be safe, and you will constantly hear claims to this effect. But as you noted, if it were true that guns were these magical, you know, had this magical capacity to prevent crime, we would have by far the lowest crime rate of major industrialized nations, and certainly for homicide, we lead by a dramatic magnitude. Right now, we have a murder rate of roughly 4.5 per 100,000, and most other industrialized nations are at one or below, so four and a half times as great or more.
Thanks for your call, Matt. Let's go next to Vicki in Thanesville. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Vicki.
It's my understanding that Congress really refuses to fund public health research by the CDC that might result in gun control recommendations. And I just wondered if your guest could talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, indeed. Unfortunately, the Centers for Disease Control and their public health arena started to do some research on the benefits of gun control, and needless to say, that is information that the National Rifle Association is very unhappy to have out there, and so they managed to put pressure on Congress to stop that funding. So there's been very little work funded by the federal government on gun control over the last 20 years now. The Obama administration has been trying to change that, but it's a pretty hostile environment, and if you're a government bureaucrat trying to avoid the displeasure of Republican chairmen of various oversight committees, you probably don't want to be doing gun research at this point.
It's hard to imagine, maybe you can imagine better than I can, any other issue where you have 90% of Americans wanting a certain piece of legislation, and it's a fairly simple one, just a universal background check, and they've been wanting this for quite some time. For that not to become something that Congress will consider is really kind of flabbergasting.
Well, it is, although think of the fact that Mitt Romney pays, 13 or 14% of an income tax rate on his very substantial annual earnings, and, I'm paying, 45%. Probably 90% of Americans would object to that as well, but the financial sector has great power over the making of laws in the tax realm. And so this is another area where a commercial interest has essentially seized the controls of power at the congressional level. But, it's lamentable and really a disgrace on our democracy that this is true, but that is the fact now. Although the public has an ability to rise up against that. There's no reason that Mitt Romney should be paying under 15%, and there's no reason that we shouldn't have universal background checks in the U.S., given the vast number of preponderance of the people who would support both of those changes.
Thanks, Vicki, for your call. Mike in Rusk County, hi.
Hi. I agree with a number of the points the guest is trying to make, but I don't agree with what I believe is his premise, or where what I'm perceiving to be his premise, that the issue is the NRA or the strength of the NRA or gun lobbies, gun manufacturers' lobbies. The real issue here is the inability of the gun control forces to get their fragmented story straight and actually focus on issues that they can do and leave the other stuff off the table until they can get those very simple approaches. Like you said, I'm a gun owner. I'm a former NRA member. I do not believe in banning guns. I don't believe in a lot of those. I believe in concealed carry. But I also believe that we are not going to keep guns out of hands of felons, and we're not going to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally unstable unless we have an effective background check and an effective way to monitor the effectiveness of the background check. But the problem is, and this is what the NRA leverages again and again in their messaging, is that as soon as you start to talk about some reasonable activity, one of your members of the coalition or one of the people that are promoting it are going to come out, and then we'll get the guns later. And then, and they bring that message forward, and as soon as they do it, they shut that 80% of gun owners that are agreeable to a more effective background check. That 80% now is going to drop to well below 50% because you guys can't get your message straight.
But the last message, Mike, that has been trying to get through Congress was very simply on a universal background check. Even that couldn't make it through Congress.
But the problem, Kathleen, is that the very same people that were promoting, recognizable members or senators or congressmen that were part of the coalition trying to make that go forward, when they would stand up, or their representatives, speech people, and so forth, would stand up, and then they would go beyond that measure, and they would start talking about, this is a first step to making sure that we have better and more effective gun control laws, and getting AK-47s off the street, and going into areas other than the area, which is something that there is agreement on.
Professor Donahue.
Well, I would hope that we could at least start with the things that there is very strong agreement on, and it is absolutely true that there is a lot of difference of opinion on the gun question, and right now, as the caller suggests, the NRA is able to sort of leverage that power to stop all measures, and indeed. A number of years ago, a number of liberal law professors made the point, let's give them the Second Amendment, which was a very controversial interpretation of the Second Amendment that the Supreme Court adopted in 2008. The idea being, well, if gun owners have the Second Amendment, they'll settle down and they'll know that their guns can't be confiscated, and then we'll be able to get reasonable gun control measures. That turned out to be probably the worst fallacy that you could imagine, because the NRA has leveraged that additional power now to try to stop every form of gun control. So it's a tough issue. I appreciate the caller's insight, which I think is a valid one. But hopefully at some point the democracy will work as it should, and the views of the 90% will prevail over the views of the very small commercial interests.
You really think so?
I do think that there is hope in this arena where you know, we just saw that there was a response in the South over the Confederate flag. Mm-hmm. You know, there were the recent movements on the issue of gay rights seemed unimaginable a number of years ago, and the strength of the belief in universal background checks is so strong that I think that ultimately we're going to get there. Remember, after the Columbine killings, Wayne LaPierre of the NRA said, oh, of course we're in favor of universal background checks. So when the NRA thinks they're in trouble, they will concede on this very issue. Now they feel strong, so he goes around and says, you know, only a communist or something would be in favor of universal background checks. But at some point, the people will have the power to rise up. Unfortunately, it will probably take an even more atrocious killing than either Newtown or Charleston to move them.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Shaw in Minneapolis. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi.
So I actually grew up in the UK, so I now live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Obviously, you know, somebody mentioned that there are 300 million guns in America, so you can't just take them all away. However, I do feel that, you know, better registration of those guns of the owners and the background check you just mentioned would definitely help us a bit. And then secondly, you know, one of the things we've always thought about living in Europe is, why do Americans need automatic assault rifles? What's the need for AK-47s or M16s? So that's another avenue we should definitely look at and see, you know, why do you need to have these guns? So I think those two factors could perhaps contribute to a more safer community.
Did you feel safer in the UK?
A lot safer. I've never ever seen a handgun until I came to the United States. Hmm. So I spent about 25 years, my first 25 years in England, and the first time I ever witnessed a handgun was in America.
Professor Donahue.
Yeah, I don't think many Americans, or as many Americans as one would like, appreciate how much safer you are in the countries that we think of as our natural competitor countries. Obviously, you know, countries like Guatemala or you know, Mexico or Haiti or something like that have much higher rates of crime than the U.S., but we usually don't think of ourselves as compared to them. We think of ourselves as compared to, you know, Europe or Japan, other affluent countries. And if you walk around in those countries, there's just much, much less to fear, because there's very little chance that someone's going to jump out with a gun and try to rob you, and robberies, unfortunately, can go very bad very quickly if a gun is involved.
Thank you so much, Shaw, for your call. We go to Katie in Janesville next. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hi, Katie.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier you had mentioned that the U.S. has over 300 million or 300 billion, I don't remember which, of guns.
Million, yeah.
And you had said that a lot of that is, you know, not necessarily that many people, but, you know, people own multiple guns. And what I was wondering, with that many guns, what is the actual percentage of guns per death versus, you know, how many cars we have here in the U.S.? And again, you have people, you know, multiple owners of multiple vehicles, and vehicles, say, like for drunk driving. My point being that we don't put the emphasis on drunk driving like what we do on guns. And my assumption here is that the percentage of gun deaths per the amount of guns is actually lower than, say, drunk driving or car accidents versus, you know, the percentage of cars. And I was just wondering if your guest would know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that there are more deaths from car accidents than there are from you know, homicide, gun homicides, although the numbers are pretty close if you add up all of the gun deaths, which would include not only gun homicides as well as gun accidents and gun suicides. So clearly drunk driving is a very important public health issue, and we're definitely getting better with that, and the rates of driving deaths are declining very dramatically in the United States, which is a good thing. But certainly auto deaths are a major public health concern as well.
Tell me about this law in San Francisco requiring guns not in use to be stored safely. It was dealt a blow, you write, this month when the U.S. Supreme Court, overstriding dissent by Thomas and Scalia, refused to consider that San Francisco law. Are there many such laws?
Yes. The number of jurisdictions that are passing these safe storage laws in the United States is growing, although the problem is just having it in a local area like San Francisco is much less effective than having it more broadly around the entire United States. So, for example, most of the countries of Europe would have these safe storage requirements. Essentially, what the San Francisco law says is you're allowed to, you know, carry the gun in your home as you see fit, but when you leave the home or you're not using it, it should be safely stored. And there are two reasons why that makes good sense. Because a gun, especially a loaded gun that is left around the house, is a danger for children coming
sure.
across the gun and using it inappropriately. But even more potently, guns get stolen so often in this country that every time that happens, a gun gets stolen, that is transferring a gun from a law-abiding citizen to a criminal. And that's something that we really need to take a look at if we really want to stop the gun problem. Remember, I mentioned universal background checks. Right now, any criminal can buy a gun, anytime he or she wants, just by avoiding the current background check requirement. So we can shut off that loophole if we can ever overcome the opposition of the NRA. But we still have to deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of guns are stolen every year, and the safe storage laws, which require those to be locked, provides at least one avenue to try to limit the number of thefts.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We are talking about, in the wake of yet another mass shooting, the president saying that we as a country will have to reckon with the fact this kind of mass violence doesn't happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. It is in our power to do something about it. So what do you think we should do about it is the question of the hour. Our guest is Professor John Donahue. He's a law professor at Stanford University and has been doing research on gun use and violence in this country for some 25 years. To you, more phone calls in a moment. Our lines have been pretty busy, as you can imagine, on this subject. So in case you can't get through, you're ever so welcome to leave your messages on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also, you can send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Craig next in Onalaska. Hi, Craig.
Good afternoon. I'm fairly pessimistic about anything getting done in this country until we get public financing of our elections. There's way too much money being donated to politicians who will not and do not listen to the people. You know, Ford Motor Company doesn't accept money from General Motors when they hire their CEO, and I don't understand why the people of this country want to let a very, very small minority of people pick their representatives and let those people make decisions that are generally not in the people's best interest.
I think you're right that is a big problem, and indeed some of the interests that we're talking about are trying to put in constitutional impediments against these sorts of public funding requirements, in part to sustain the power of the economic interests who like things as they are right now.
Thanks, Craig, for your call. Tony in Door County. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello, Professor Donahue. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I recently took the concealed carry class in Wisconsin, and as a pseudo-journalist, I was interested in the process because I've never shot a gun in my life.
Uh-huh.
And it was a one-day course, and it was about the legal ramifications of who to shoot and how to shoot and what to do if you do shoot someone. And so I have a concealed carry permit. I have no plans on buying a gun, but I do have a permit. And what I found interesting about the class was half the class was speaking to how to protect ourselves from the bad guys, but then the other half was also how to protect ourselves from the good guys. So I thought that was pretty provocative. And my last realization was that if people are going to have a legal permit to carry a handgun, I would much rather know who has the handgun legally, because the bad guys will always have a concealed carry non-permit, and I would much rather know who the legal bearers of guns are versus the other.
Now, when you mentioned that half the people were interested in protecting themselves from the good guys, what did you mean by that?
Well, it was half the conversation in the class. Uh-huh. Because a lot of the class was dedicated to what do you do when you're pulled over on the road in a traffic stop, and how do you express to the officer that you have a handgun? Should you have a GoPro camera on your dashboard? Should you be videotaping this? I mean, it was weird, and I was just taking this stuff in, and I'm really on both sides of the conversation, so I have no bias on this one way or the other. Yet it was very two-sided.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting comment, as your call suggests, there are so many different opinions on the gun question. Occasionally I debate people and they say, oh, of course we know guns are not going to protect against criminals, but we think that they're going to protect us from, the federal government taking over. And so that's one very strong strand of belief among a certain element of the public. I think it's a very unwise view to think that the federal government is going to be threatened by some citizens carrying handguns. If you look over at Iraq, what the federal government of the United States worries about are bombs, and so a single Iraqi with a gun is not a threat to the American military, nor would it be a threat in the United States. Not to mention the fact that it's sort of treason to think about attacking the federal government, but that's another matter.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about the gun that was used in the Charleston shootings, the Glock semi-automatic handgun. How would somebody like this Dylan Roof guy get a gun like that, and why would you even buy a gun like that?
Well, that is probably one of the most common handguns purchased today. Mm. So it's a very commonly used and purchased handgun. And, he had just turned 21. So under the Heller decision, which was handed down by the Supreme Court in 2008, he had a constitutional right to buy that gun. And that was the one that he chose. In some states, that gun would not be permitted, but in his particular state of South Carolina, there was no obstacle to him buying that gun. But I think you also raise an interesting point, which is in the Newtown killings. The mother in that case, living in one of the safest areas of the United States, had bought into the NRA idea that you need your arsenal to protect you from the coming waves of attack. it was a completely crazy idea for her to have, living in such an incredibly safe place and then exposing herself to the enormous dangers of her own son, who ended up killing her, of course. And this is the type of irrationality that is so prevalent in the gun arena that it's very troublesome to see. And there are some indications that the family of Dylan Rust, made money available to him to be able to buy this gun. And, I think it's one thing that you want the government to engage in behaviors that can reduce the number of guns in the hands of people who will use them inappropriately, but also parents and family have a role to play here, and one should be very zealous, I think, to keep guns out of the hands of troubled and angry young men, because that is not a good recipe. Mm-hmm. And if you may not care about other people, but if you care about yourself and your children, you do want to be far more cautious than both of these sets of parents seem to be.
And when you say he couldn't have purchased the gun in some places, you mean in some states you would not be allowed to buy the Glock semi-automatic handgun?
Yeah, any state that has a limitation on the high capacity magazines would have limited that type of gun, because it carried more than 10 bullets in the clip. So it depends on the nature of the laws in the particular jurisdiction. That is another issue. One of the callers mentioned earlier that he would be in favor of universal background checks, but maybe not in favor of other measures. One measure that is somewhat more controversial, but is worth considering, is it a good idea to limit the number of bullets that any semi-automatic weapon can fire? And certainly the Newtown families have come out strongly in that point, because when Adam Lanza had to reload his magazine after shooting 30 or 31 times, a number of children, I think 11 children, were able to run out of the classroom. So making mass shooters reload can be a valuable way to save lives.
Yeah. One more phone call and then we're out of time. Lynn in Butler. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. I actually called in on one topic, but I came up with a couple of others listening to some of your comments there. The Colorado massacre Columbine was done during the last assault weapons ban and reduced capacity magazine requirements, so that doesn't help. I own Glocks, carry Glocks. I bought them because they fit my hand and arm architecture well. I can handle them easily and safely. The one that I usually carry came from the factory with a standard 17-round magazine. I use them in part because they are extensively field-tested by law enforcement and military around the world. They're very reliable, and if I'm going to trust my life to something, that's what I want.
That's all the time we have. I'm sorry. Professor Donahue, let's get a response to that.
People make choices for their own personal safety based on their preferences, but I would just suggest that the Navy SEALs don't have 17 bullets in their handguns, and maybe Americans here in the United States may not need as many as well.
Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Professor John Donahue, he is a law professor at Stanford University. He has been researching gun violence and what can be done to prevent it in this country for 25 years. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Please stay with us. News is coming up in just a moment, and then we'll be looking at this wonderful exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum, where actually you can go in and stand in the wonderful part of the building that overlooks the lake that Calatrava designed, and it's, you don't even have to see art, that's art. But you should see art, too, in this exhibit. So we'll be talking about Van Gogh to Pollock as we continue our Wednesday afternoon conversations. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for your contributions on a controversial issue. The news is coming up.